Hello, everybody out there, and welcome to another episode of Discussions with David, a program I started when the pandemic lockdown hit, and I've kept on going in the at this point in a two-day-a-week form every Wednesday and Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. And then on Tuesdays, I host Fifth Estate Live at the same times, 10 a.m. Pacific and 1 p.m. Eastern. And you can find them all on various platforms, including the Facebook pages of Cable Community Radio and the Facebook page of Popular Resistance, both of which we are currently broadcasting on, among various other places. And then these broadcasts all get turned into podcasts afterwards, which you can find if you look up This Week with David Rovics, wherever you get your podcasts. And today I have the great pleasure of bringing to you one of my favorite songwriters who I first met and first heard as a teenager, when I was a teenager, and he was a little bit older than that. So with no further ado, I will bring to you from Western Massachusetts, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, Charlie King. Great to have you here. Hey,
good to be here,
Charlie. Yeah. Charlie, you know, one of the things I think about when I think about you is the whole phenomenon with which I'm now, as a 53-year-old songwriter at this point, also familiar with to some extent myself. But the whole phenomenon of people actually growing up listening to your music, a couple of generations, and you've done a lot of playing at summer camps and which is the context that I think I first heard about you in, was around the Unitarian and other related summer camps of New England, which I also sort of grew up in and amongst in Western Massachusetts. I went to Roe Camp as a junior high camper. I don't think you ever came to my camp when I was a camper there, but it was that sort of milieu you were very actively playing in, and I just want to kind of start there randomly enough. I never know where to start these things, but that seems like a nice random place to start, the summer camps and that kind of milieu there in New England. And then now that I should form this into some kind of a question here, but it's, you know, when I first was touring with Allie Rosenblatt, who you met many years ago, you know, she was one of the folks who went to a camp with a history of being a communist Jewish camp, summer camp for kids, in of which there used to be many, of which there are very few now, but she grew up listening. I mean, you were sort of a formative element of her childhood, as you were for many other kids who went to many of these left-wing summer camps, many of which don't exist now. But it's still not a question, is it? But riff on that, if you would.
Well, I think the camp that Allie refers to is Camp Kenderland.
Kenderland. I was trying to remember the K.
Yeah. That used to be in the Hudson River Valley, where a lot of left-wing and union activists sent their kids up to camp in the summer, and some were family camps, brought their whole families up. By the time I started singing at Kenderland, they had moved to Western Massachusetts because the property that they built their camp on in the Hudson River Valley was seized by the government during the McCarthy era. And I don't know the mechanics of that. I remember asking one of the matriarchs at Camp Kenderland, you know, how could the government seize your land? And she just rolled her eyes and walked away. So I guess it was pretty clear to her how that happens. But I guess 40 or so years ago, I was invited to come up and sing at Camp Kenderland. This is the first summer in those 40 years that I wasn't able to do it because of the pandemic, although we did do an online concert, and probably more kids at that concert than I get at the when I show up in person. It's been a great experience for me. It's the only place in the world where I'm treated as a rock star. I really relish that experience. When I turn on my computer, the wallpaper or whatever you call the image that comes up on the screen as I begin my tedious day, is of a bunch of kids on their feet screaming, singing, what song? Oh, singing, Garbage, the song Garbage together. Or maybe it's the song, You Can Live in Your Car. What's that? A Peter and Lou Berryman song. There are like three or four songs that I have to sing every year or they won't let me leave. So they're very enthusiastic. And I'm running on about Camp Kinderland because it's pretty much the only summer camp that I sang at with any regularity. I know it's a great tradition. I know that's a way that Pete Seeger built an audience during the when the Blacklist was hitting him hardest. I have sung at Row, but not for kids. I put out a children's album. Everyone had to, and I love to go back to Kinderland year after year. But I never have really thought of myself as having the kind of skills that I see in children's musicians. I've got some good friends. Hugh Hanley is one of them, and who just have a lot of skill working with kids. And I'm lucky that Camp Kinderland has a singing tradition. So you can go to Camp Kinderland. I can go there. I can sing Two Good Arms, this kind of mournful song about Sacco and Vanzetti, and they all sing along. You know, they were well prepped for me by the time I got there. So
that's right. Because what makes all the difference is if you're part of their culture and they're well prepped, or like whether or not it's officially children's music or not, if they've heard it much, then it becomes part of the culture. But that's interesting to hear that it's the only camp that you have been singing at regularly, because it's such a, for the people who went to that camp, I think in their imaginations, you would be doing that in other places as well. And you're not just a rock star at that one, at the one camp, which is interesting, because it kind of brings me to one other thing that I was thinking about, as a musician of my generation or your generation, I think we're both in a similar boat and thinking about this inevitably, no matter how much we would rather avoid such thoughts. But the fact that you talk about having really playing for the past 40 years at the one, basically one remaining left-wing summer camp in the Northeast, perhaps you could say, do you often feel like you got into this traveling and performing thing like 5 years too late? Because there was so many people just a little bit older than you, when this like some of the people who are quoted on your website saying nice things about you. I think of Tom Paxton. I mean, if he were more left wing and had a beard, I think he could. It would be an apt comparison. He became far more well known, and I wonder how much of that was just accident of timing.
There is that, but I have no complaints on that score. I think we all sort of fit into the scene that we find ourselves in. My ability to become a viable touring artist, making, six figures some years, it was because I grew up with the peace movement and got involved in the Seabrook nuclear power plant occupation. And so when I envisioned taking my music on the road, that was one of the main factors, was that I was part of the Seabrook Clamshell Alliance and had written songs in that about the issue of nuclear power, safe energy. And there were all of these anti-nuclear alliances springing up around the country in the wake of the Seabrook occupation. So there was a kind of ready-made audience for me. And then there was also an odd economic advantage. I don't know if you if you were able to take advantage of these, or they came along too late, but they used to have these 30-day tickets that you could buy on the airlines, and they were under $500. So for $15 a day, I could fly all over the country. And also,
that's before my time.
Yeah,
okay, that's amazing. That sounds incredible.
Well, today they might pay you $15 to fly some. But so that meant, you know, I could call up Ted Warmbrand in Tucson and say, you know, can I come in and do a concert in Tucson? And he would say, well, I don't know if I can afford you. And I said, well, how about $100 and I'll sell my records? And he said, okay, $100. Okay, how are you going to get here? I said, well, I'll fly. And he said, well, how can you fly here for $100? So that was pretty much the way I first built my touring schedule. If you looked at my early touring schedule, it would only be in places where at that time Allegheny Airlines, or maybe by that time it was US Air, I can't remember, only in places that they flew to. And right. Someday, you know, on a Tuesday, if I couldn't get a concert somewhere, I'd fly across country just to get a couple of meals.
Because enough it's about part of the 30-day thing. Oh, I think that is a fascinating the cup half empty, cup half full question is always part of anything. But I asked if you felt you were born too late to take advantage mm-hmm. of the folk scare of the '60s. But what you're pointing out is so incredibly relevant. I think, especially you were just mentioning this flying around thing that I've never even heard of, which sounds like an amazing way to set up a tour, to have this 30-day window like that. But then I keep on running into very regularly great musicians who are just maybe 20 years younger than me, who have never had the experience of traveling and selling merchandise. It's just a fantasy, you know. And there's a lot of ways that in many different aspects of life, but like when you're talking about the music industry, in many ways, like it's just been in a constant state of decline for both of our entire careers, in a sense, but especially in the past 20 years, right? Just shrinking. And I mean, I don't know what's the question, but what can you talk about that trajectory of, back in the 90s, getting good paying gigs, selling lots of merch. I don't know when the years were that you were making six figures, but but this really is a real phenomenon, and people, some musicians. Did you said six figures?
I meant four.
Four figures,
including the .00 at the end. You
know? Okay, that's a lot easier to get to arrive at. Because I mean, even you know, I've never made, certainly never made six figures, but it is. At the peak of when it was common, like even in the 90s, I'd say when it was common for people, for speakers and for musicians, both including on the left, to be getting paid sometimes thousands of dollars to perform at college campuses, and then you'd sell many hundreds of dollars worth of merch at one of those gigs. I mean, there were people making six figures. I certainly don't know. On the sort of independent circuit, it just doesn't seem like most of those gigs exist anymore. Like those college gigs that I know many of us used to get. Has that been your experience with the college gigs as well? They just kind of dried up.
Quite a while ago.
Yeah, like 20 years ago.
I think the big impact for me has been on selling recordings. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, the fact that all the work has disappeared, or at least all of the in-person work has disappeared. But
with the pandemic.
Yes, thanks. Mm-hmm. My touring life and the livelihood I was able to make from that, which is very modest, was tied into working primarily for political active groups. Doing benefit concerts or just doing concerts sponsored by groups that were involved in political activism. And that didn't really disappear. That didn't decline. And I think it's, well, I can't say now, because I have kind of aged out of it. I don't think it's so much that I've lost the ability to find sponsoring groups to play for. I think that the music that I do is less likely to draw an audience. I sort of built an audience over the years, and many of them are dead now, and the rest don't drive at night. So I'm not seeing, I'm seeing fewer and fewer people at the concerts that I do. And, you know, part of the strategy for that was working with other performers. You know, I've worked with Annie Patterson and Peter Blood. I've worked with the Prince Mishkins. And so we kind of combine our audiences. And that's worked pretty well. I don't think I would do it. If everything opened up tomorrow, I don't think I'd do another solo tour. It's not much fun. I don't really have the audience draw that I had at one time.
And you've always, I mean, you've long done a lot of touring with other musicians, which is, not an uncommon thing, but also you've often toured as a duo with your partners who are also your singing partners, in particularly Karen Brandau for 15 years. Yeah. And, yeah. That changes the dynamic of touring from a sort of perpetually lonely endeavor to one that's either full of companionship or sometimes perhaps too full of companionship, depending on if you get tired of being with each other 24 hours a day. But
that never happened when I was touring with Karen Brandau. We worked very well together, and also she was not she didn't suffer fools lightly. When we would get to that familiar spot where the concert was over, and we go back to the house of the people in the neighborhood who were going to put us up for the evening, and the guy that helped to run the soundboard or something has decided that there's nothing more interesting for the traveling performer than to hear about his life. And so you would sit there, as I'm sure you have, you know, and it's 11 o'clock and then it's midnight and then it's 1 o'clock in the morning and this guy is still talking. Well, Karen would have been asleep 2 hours by then. So that was about the only time that we weren't together, but we worked well together. We traveled well together. We lived well together. Yeah. And she died well. She knew in a year in advance she was going to die, and she did it well. I think we did it well together. Stopped touring at that point, of course. Yeah.
Was it touring together with Karen that was, I mean, you did so many different, you put together so many different performances that involve telling stories from history, and that tend to work a lot better with two people doing it than as a monologue, right? Is that you tended to work them out as a two-person thing, or did you also do those presentations by yourself, like about history of the First World War and the IWW and the history of nonviolent civil disobedience, the civil rights movement? I've been looking at your website this morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I've also seen some of these. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very difficult to do those as a soloist. And as a matter of fact, I mean, part of the difficulty is it's much more interesting when it becomes a kind of back and forth between two people or more. I've done it with as many as four people. Some of the IWW shows that we've done with George Mann and with Magpie. And also, it's very difficult to play the guitar and work a PowerPoint drive at the same time. I think Dave Lippmann figured out how to do it with his feet, but I never could.
With a pedal, yeah. A pedal made of duct tape, I think. Yeah.
That specifically, those performances were almost impossible to do solo. I've never sort of traveled with an opening act. I've never traveled with someone who was a backup musician. All the people that I've worked with have been people who are soloists in their own right. And we would spend a good chunk of time putting together a show that was full of harmonies and duo work. And I think actually working with Karen was a good model for that. Although before that, I traveled with Bright Morning Star being the big example. That was a pretty good run. And there were seven of us in Bright Morning Star.
And that was where you kind of got, that was the first sort of act that you were performing in was Bright Morning Star in the 70s. Yeah. And you guys played a lot at anti-nuclear protests as well.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. That was part of the circuit. I continued to do solo work back then because Bright Morning Star was sort of an expensive hobby. We would, go out on tour for 3 or 4 weeks and come back and then pass the hat, you know, everybody pitching $20 to cover our expenses and go home, you know, muttering to ourselves. It was actually, that's what brought us down, Bright Morning Star, was we were making better music than we'd ever made before, but we couldn't figure out a way to make it pay with 7 or 8 people on the road.
It's always a problem with big bands, I guess. I mean, I've never figured out how to make that work either. So it makes a lot of people discover how well they can do as a single solo or duo act, and yeah, making that work.
Being a duo act with Karen made a lot more sense because we were one household. But in other situations, you're splitting the proceeds 2 or 3 ways, and that gets kind of slim. I'm not really cash dependent. I'm not cash driven on doing concerts or selling recordings anymore, although they are taking up an awful lot of space in my garage at the moment.
Yeah, mine too. My poor daughter's bedroom is full of boxes of CDs that we'll never sell.
Yeah. I'm fortunate enough to have kind of got in on the ground floor with Local 1000, the Traveling Musicians Union. And when we were organizing that, I was sort of the point man on trying to figure out how to gain access to the musicians' pension plan. And so I began, I worked with folks to figure out a way to do that. And I began filing contracts and having pension contributions made fairly early in my working life. And the pension plan was much more solid back then than it is now. So when I was, I think, 58 or 59, I started collecting a pension. When I was 62, I started collecting Social Security, motivated primarily by the fact that I didn't want to be making choices about performing solely based on who could pay me. It's really taken an enormous load off of my mind to be doing that. And now, actually, between the pension and Social Security, I have a monthly income that is in excess of anything that I ever made when I was working full time. So, but the reason that comes up is, you know, I can go off and work with Annie and Peter. With Rick and Andy and the Prince Michigans, you know, and it is not of a great concern to me that we're splitting the pay, you know, so many different ways. And it really puts the focus more on just the joy of doing this work. I mean, you know, what a privilege. Here we are, old gray-haired men, and we've made it through life without having to work for Walmart or something like that. You know, I did. For 1 year, I had a lean year where I drove truck for a year, and I was very happy to get back on the road as a singer after that. So I pretty much come through life unscathed by labor.
Yeah, right. And then, I feel so lucky to be among that select group. But it's also like when you're listening to the NPR and other media about the state of artists and hearing about how, you know, it sounds like the overwhelming majority of them have other jobs in order to pay the rent. And those other jobs are in the service sector. So they've lost their gigs and they've lost their other jobs. And you just start to realize what a very small number of people there are out there who are actually making a living at this sort of thing in the first place, even before the pandemic.
And I should say that I would never have been able to live based on my income as a singer. I've always been part of a two-income household. And so, you know, in a good year, I could hold up my half. But I've actually thought about you a lot in the years where you seem to be like the number one road warrior in America. And I mean, how many days were you living in your vehicle at that point?
At the peak, like 20 years ago, I was probably touring like 10 months out of the year. You know, it was living in my van, and then I started touring in Europe too. So it was just constant, really, until I started having kids in 2006. That's when I stopped touring all the time. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. So for most of my, well, for actually all of my working career, if you could call it that, singing songs, I've had a home, had an address, and, had health insurance, all kinds of nice things. And it I wouldn't have been able to do any of that based on my income, you know? Yeah.
And then, although what about playing from quite as early in your career, you've also been, I guess, explicitly political would be a fair term. I mean, lots of artists, especially in the 70s, weren't expressing political perspectives, but do you feel like you as an artist, might have had a chance to not get pigeonholed in a political sort of artistic corner, or was it just inevitable, or what are your thoughts on that? I remember once complaining to Utah Phillips when I was young, I felt like, you know, there was no chance of getting out of this sort of little left-wing musical corner, and he said, well, what are you complaining about? It's what, you know, why you write other songs, you know, write something other than political music, then try that.
Good advice from Utah. I have, people have said to me, you know, gosh, you know, if you had just, you know, been a popular singer, you would have made a lot more money, been a little more successful. That was never an option for me. I mean, you've heard me perform. I'm not a great singer. I'm not a great guitarist. I've managed to collect a lot of interesting songs. I've written a few myself. And basically, I've made it this far on a repertoire, on a good repertoire. But
I just interject that everything you just said about yourself could also be said about Tom Paxton. I'm going on my previous point about that.
Well,
sorry, please continue. I mean, it could be said about a lot of people who are really famous.
Tom is far more prolific than I am. And
is he?
less and less each year, I distinguish myself as a songwriter. More and more, I'm singing other people's songs, which is one of the nice things about working with the Prince Michigans. They've got such a rich repertoire of their own. Tom has probably written as many or more political songs as I have, but that would be a small percentage of his total output, you know? And Tom, as you mentioned, you know, came along a bit earlier, where commercial venues existed. I've never played many commercial venues, you know. Used to be I'd play once a year at the Arc, but that was only because a local peace and justice group would sponsor me there. I've played now and then at Passim's. They usually tell me that I've got an afternoon show or something like that. So commercial venues have not been important for me. And I wouldn't disparage Paxton's political work, but
oh, no.
He may have been cursed by success. You know, every night I have to sit down when I'm touring. I have to, at least when I'm touring solo, I have to sit down and create a set list that's based on where I'm going, who's sponsoring me, what's their agenda, how can I be supportive of that agenda, what did I sing last year, because this is a group that brings me in every year. And what did I sing for the last 10 years? I mean, one of the biggest storage issues I have is my set list. So I've got every set list on paper that I've done since when? I don't know, maybe 1977. Wow. I don't go back that far in planning a set list because my repertoire evolves beyond that. But, you know, if I sing in Tucson, for example. Ted Warmbrand brings me to Tucson every year. It takes me a long time to come up with a set list for Tucson because I've been so overexposed there.
Yeah, because you don't want to do what you did the year before.
If I hadn't evolved in the late 1960s as a political singer and songwriter, I wouldn't have been able to get work doing anything in the entertainment field. I don't have the chops to be a popular musician. I just have this political repertoire, and that's what I'm drawn to in terms of other people's music. That's what I'm drawn to in terms of other performers. You know, I've never toured with John Gorka or even John McCutcheon. Not that they've asked me and I've turned them down, but, I've toured with Bev Grant, you know, I've toured with the Mishkins, you know, Annie Patterson, she's very, political and a great advocate for racial justice. Marcia Taylor, Martha Leader, Deborah Silverstein, all these people have written so many great songs with labor or economic justice or safe energy framework. So it's always been a political show. And before I started touring, when I was living at the Community for Nonviolent Action in Connecticut, we were, among other things, a political action center, and we were also a conference center. So we had to plan conferences, and we said, where are all the people who were doing political music in the 60s? Where are they now? And this would have been 1977. And we were thinking about the people who were doing kind of the grunt work like we have done, you know, singing at rallies, singing on picket lines, you know, where are they now and what are they doing? That's where the People's Music Network comes from. You know, we
cool.
had Songs of Freedom and Struggle conference and said, you know, are you still doing this music? Or do you feel lonely? Do you have a sense of community? And so we got together, I don't know, maybe 60, 70 people, and spent a weekend singing to each other and made a list of everybody who was there and, you know, mimeographed the names and addresses for everyone. And so it's been, yeah, political music has been, I think, the only viable musical niche that I could have lived with. I wasn't bad as a truck driver, but I didn't get a lot of satisfaction.
And I would add too that the People's Music Network is definitely another venue in which Charlie King is a rock star, in addition to Camp Kinderland. But I can tell you from my own experience as a young attendee at PMN, I think my first PMN conference, I don't know how old I was. And I guess I was already into my 20s, but I was still very young anyway. But
yeah, it's still going.
Yeah, still going.
And this surprises me. It may not surprise you. Since the pandemic, our membership has doubled.
Oh, wow. Because everybody, yeah, that actually doesn't surprise me, because there's always the issue of geography, where if people want to go to one of those gatherings, inevitably it's hard to, if they don't live in the Northeast, but with the online stuff, they can be anywhere in the world that's probably other than Australia or Japan or somewhere where the time zone really sucks for whatever we're doing in North America. Usually there's only the time zone issues to contend with at this point.
Yeah, and like you, Ben Grosskopf, who's the executive director now of People's Music Network, realized the potential of bringing people together for online performances, and that has really energized the people who are doing this kind of music now, and brought a lot of people into the PMN fold. That's been good.
It's been good. And also, in terms of just sort of political education, popular education, also just morale, keeping up morale, cheerleading. I mean, all the things that we can do in physical spaces, we can do at least in some proximate way online. And that's been really good for a lot of folks, at least in lieu of the, you know, I mean, there's real pros and cons, which have been very interesting with the whole online thing, although I think most of us are really sick of it. We'd rather be getting back to the physical world. Can you talk about the phenomenon that we're also sort of touching on there of being sort of a cheerleader for social movements and struggles, and how, you know, traveling around and whether you're doing it online or in the physical world and playing for different groups and coming up with set lists that are relevant for the struggles that they're involved with, like that is it's a particular and special role for folks like us to be in this sort of what I call cheerleader. But I mean, that's just a trite term, I guess, but it's just we're sort of like supporting movements in this particular musical way. Any particular reflections or anecdotes or just anything that comes to mind when I talk about using music in that way?
Yeah. Well, I already talked about the process of coming into a community and putting together a concert that speaks to the community needs. I mean, it's what you've been doing as rooted in Portland. This is more of a gadfly model where, you know, I would fly into Portland or drive into Portland and put together a show that would speak to all that's going on there. My son and daughter-in-law are being quite active down in Louisville, where Breonna Taylor was murdered. And, you know, so you have to be sensitive to what's going on in the community, who's sponsoring you, and you put together a show that serves them and speaks to their needs. You know, as much as anything, that's a survival instinct, because you don't want to be boring and you don't want to be irrelevant, you know, but you do want to support those causes. And we don't go in and sing for the, I don't know, the Chamber of Commerce. These are the people that want to hear us, and they're the ones who invite us. I am more drawn to the kind of model of the Freedom Singers, or other people who worked in the civil rights movement in the 1960s. For me, being in the Clamshell Alliance would be an early example of it, and working with an organization called the Journey of Hope, which is trying to abolish the death penalty in the United States. And I've been working with them it's coming on 30 years now. Is that possible? Yeah, coming on 30 years traveling with them. So with the Journey of Hope, I would be this with a group of people for 17 days. And my role, beyond just the kind of structural grunt work of driving vans and passing petitions around and passing the basket and introducing speakers, because Journey of Hope is made up of people who've been impacted by the death penalty, whether they're murder victims, family members, or people who have been exonerated from death row, or, you know, so they're, I would be, you know, there would be speakers, and my job one of my jobs would be to drop in a song between speakers to kind of break or shift the mood. But a big part of being with that group, and probably the largest musical role I would have, would be when everyone comes back from a day of speaking in churches and law schools and libraries and places like that. You know, just beat to the bone from exposing some of the most horrific experiences in their life, we would sit around and, you know, somebody bring in a case of beer, and we would just sit in a circle and, you know, just sing old songs, you know, old Beatles songs, you know, old Bob Dylan songs, Paul Simon, songs that everybody seems to know, and just kind of kicking back and releasing a lot of pressure. Or another example, a little bit different, would be with the School of the Americas Watch, where each year. It used to be at Fort Benning, Georgia, and was for many years before it shifted to the Mexican border on the southern edge of Arizona, Sonora, Mexico. But back when it was at Fort Benning, we had a music collective, probably a dozen musicians, and we would arrive a day early and we would meet in a motel room and we figure out what songs we're going to sing from the stage, what songs we're going to sing as we march to the detention centers. And, one of many people, and we would learn a body of songs or remember or put together a body of songs, freedom songs, solidarity songs, and be there for 3 or 4 days having the music serve the cause. So that's been a really important experience for me, to be embedded in a movement and to sing songs that serve the purpose of that movement and the spiritual well-being of the people that are doing that work. And I've really liked that role, even though it sort of, it takes me out of the spotlight most of the time, where, in the concert, if you do a concert, you've got a couple of hours there and you got the microphone, right? Being in those caravans of one sort or another, I feel much more useful. I feel like it really feeds my heart, and I think I'm able to do that for other people too.
I'm curious what the School of the Americas protests have been like since they moved to the border, because I haven't been to any of those, but I just wanted to say and see what your thoughts on it are, that those protests that I did attend at the School of the Americas and sang at for many years were overall, like in the course of the weekend, I would say that of any protests I've ever been involved with around the world, there was such an emphasis on music in those weekends that by the end of it, it was a real potential sort of musical, sort of political conversion experience for a lot of people, especially, I think there's loads of young people from colleges around the country that would go, and many of them probably never had the experience of going to any of those kind of summer camps like Kinderland. And this was like kind of the closest to that kind of experience in a way. I mean, I always felt I was going to camp, even though people are getting arrested, going to prison, it was real life, but still it had a real sort of adult version of Kinderland kind of atmosphere at those protests. And I think so profound, sort of popular education went on that where I think people maybe went for a good protest around a good cause, and by the end of the weekend had a whole different level of understanding about what they had just experienced and why they were actually there. But having said all that, can you reflect on those protests and maybe talk about what's been going on? Because I think you've made it to the border for some of those or not.
I have, let me see. The Fort Benning protests in Georgia, Pete Seeger said it was the singingest movement he'd been involved in since the civil rights movement. I came along 2 or 3 years into the organization of those protests in Georgia, so I'm not aware of all of the roots of it. But when I walked into that, and when you walked into that, you discover this movement where basically, they never have two speakers in a row. There's always some kind of cultural thing in between, primarily singing, but also drumming and street theater, puppeteers, stuff like that. So they felt the importance of culture. Where does that come from? I'm not sure. I don't think it's rooted in the United States. But the person that seemed to make it work was Chris and Sarah from Chicago, who sings with a group called Voices. And she was a very stern stage manager, but she made sure that there was music involved in everything. So if people came to a nonviolent training center, it started and ended with a song. If people had a workshop from Veterans for Peace, the organizers would get in touch with them, a week in advance and say, how much music do you want at your workshop? You know, and they would write back and they say, music? No, no, no. We're veterans. We're going to get together and bang our heads or something. And they would say, no, you don't do anything here without music. And people learned, you know, that music is an important part of organizing. It's an important tool. It's important for our spirit. You know, the civil rights movement knew that. The labor movement knew that. I have never done the heavy lifting for the School of the Americas Watch, so I'm not entirely sure how all decisions were made. But at one point, the numbers that were coming to Fort Benning had decreased. And the violence that was being rained down on people coming to the border, the northern Mexican border, had spiked dramatically. And so after a couple of transition years where the focus was on a for-private prison that was detaining immigrants near Fort Benning, Georgia, the decision was made by the organization to take it to the border in Sonora, Arizona, and Sonora, Mexico, which had that very ugly, 12-foot-high steel fence wall there. What was it like? The attendance was nothing like it was in Georgia at the heyday. It was far more bilingual. The stage was, the main stage was in Mexico. It was not in Arizona. It was certainly the best setting for projecting music in a live setting that we've ever worked on, most of us there. And the Mexican sound engineers were passing microphones through the wall, through the fence. And there was a pickup truck on the other side with a stage on it. And so half of us were in the Mexico side, half of us were in the U.S. side. And we were singing back and forth. We were singing harmonies on both sides of the wall, you know, all pushed through one sound system. It evolved in the direction of younger performers and in the direction of bilingual performers. It was a kind of transition period. I felt like I was doing less and listening to other people more. The Peace Poets, a wonderful group of young men, would come and do hip hop and poetry. Francisco Herrera became the kind of voice of SOA Watch on stage, and a wonderful performer in English and Spanish. So it was a transitional time, and we're all just sitting home now, so I don't know what the plans are for the future. But it was a very rich experience. I felt like when I went to Georgia, I gave a lot. I felt when I went to the border, I got a lot. I learned a lot. I heard a lot of stuff I wasn't hearing. And I was always on the Mexican side, which was the virtue of having a viable passport. I had a passport because Ann Feeney asked me to go to Ireland and lead a tour there when she got sick. And so I had a passport, so I got to go to Mexico, where other people either didn't have a passport or maybe had a shaky history like yourself, David, and not be able to get across the border so easily. So,
what was that trip to Ireland like with Anne? I wonder, though, that's because you haven't done a whole lot of touring outside of the U.S.?
I have not. It's been one of the big lacunas in my life. I didn't do it with Anne. I did it instead of Anne. When Anne first was diagnosed with a serious illness, she called me up and asked it. She had lined up this tour of a political cultural tour of Ireland, and would I do it in her stead? And I certainly couldn't fill her shoes, but at least I filled her seat on the bus, and it was great. I think I would have done more work in other countries if I didn't have kids.
You had kids pretty early on. Certainly when I first met you in the early 90s, you already had a kid who was yeah, still a small child at that point, but yeah.
Yeah, so Jamie was born in 73.
Right.
And he toured with Bright Morning Star, and he toured with me. You could get a half price ticket of the, so I was paying like $450 and I was paying $225 for him. It was just like sort of affordable childcare.
That's amazing.
He toured with me a lot. But we did it only in the United States. I don't think he and I ever crossed a border together. And what I've done has been, you know, just Canada and Mexico. That's it. And then that thing singing in Ireland. But I would love, you know, Leon Russell and I and Peggy Seeger and I correspond a bit. And I would love to go and play in Ireland, England. And I've always been kind of envious of you, David, that you would have such a strong history of performing in Europe. Christy Moore.
You're in touch with Tommy Sands too? Tommy Sands, because I know you do one of his songs, but do you know Tommy Sands as well?
Yeah, I did stay with him on an earlier trip to Ireland. I actually did do a kind of a solo thing in Ireland, mostly in the north. And I stayed with Tommy and played a number of festivals up there. And
great.
That, have you ever been to his home?
Yeah, lots of times. Yeah.
What I love it.
Wonderful.
But I had called Tommy and I said, you know, I've been invited to play at a couple of festivals over there. And could you help me get some other work singing, you know, in your area? And he kind of paused and he said, actually, we have a lot of singers here already.
That's a wonderful understatement.
But his hospitality was very gracious.
Yeah, good. Yeah, his home is the former horse stables of the Ross family estate back when Ross family owned the whole town.
They're the Ross of Ross Trevor, huh?
Ross of Ross Trevor, General Ross, who was also the general who was responsible for the burning down of the White House, the Congress, and the Supreme Court in the War of 1812. Yeah. Wow. And then he died a few months after.
Oh, he got something done.
He did get something done. He was very good for the construction industry. Oh, Charlie, it's the pandemic. You're not touring around and stuff. You're generally home in Massachusetts, but I know you pay close attention to global events. And I wonder, in the time we have left, any thoughts on the current state of affairs in the U.S. and the world, predictions for the future over the next few weeks? I know there's a lot to cover in 8 minutes, but any particular thoughts that come to mind? Do you think there's going to be an election next month?
I do. Yeah. I think that the Trump administration will lose the election. And I think I have never been a big electoral politics fan, but I feel it's really important this year for us to vote and for Trump to go down in defeat. So that's about all I can say about the election. I don't know. Candace, my partner, has been sending out letters to people in battleground states and encouraging them to go to the polls. And my son is, he's in addition to working on the ground in Louisville, he's also big on supporting progressive candidates around the country. So I'm kind of a no-show when it comes to electoral politics. I think the place where I really key in on it, or the place where I feel comfortable, is thinking about the sacrifices and the organizing that was done in the 1960s when I was just first learning folk music to secure the right to vote for African Americans in the South. And the price that people paid, you know, and think about the person of John Lewis. I think about how on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, the speakers there spoke so movingly about that period of our history and this period where voter suppression is trying to take away all of those hard-fought victories. So in a country with a history of systemic racism that's tried in every way to maintain its power by keeping people out of the ballot booth, I feel that's the place where I feel most inspired. The Sai Khan, as you know, has been really collecting songs and organizing cultural events around getting people to vote. And I sent one of my songs in at his request, and I'll be singing it on a concert that PMN is co-sponsoring with Folk Vote next week. And it's about it's rooted in a speech that Al Sharpton made at the 50th anniversary march in Washington. He was the key speaker, or he was sort of the honcho on stage. And he said, you know, that the new civil rights movement is going to be marching into every place where they're trying to restrict our right to vote. And when they ask us, do we have a valid ID, you pull out a picture of Medgar Evers.
Yeah.
Of Michael Schwerner, and you say, yeah, here's my voter ID. These people died so that I could be here voting today, and that's who you're going to have to turn away. This is who we are. That's who you said. You know, pull out those pictures. This is who we are. And since that day, I've carried a picture of James Chaney and Michael Schwerner and Andrew Goodman in my wallet, in my ID slot. Of course, in Massachusetts, we don't have to show an ID, but if anyone asks me, you know, do I have a voter ID, that's what I'm pulling out of my wallet. And that's what the song is about, three faces in a row, as my where I feel most passionate about voting.
Great. I missed this. This is a recent composition, Three Faces in a Row, that you sent to Sai?
Well, when was the 50th anniversary march? It would have been.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's recent. Yeah.
That's 2013. Yeah. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's at our stage in life, that counts as recent. So, yeah.
Yeah. I should
have. None of my kids would agree.
Stop making CDs with that song, but I didn't. Yeah. So, yeah. I think,
yeah, now in Harris County, in the sprawling county of Harris in Texas, home to Houston and 4 million people, there is only one place to drop off your voter ballot.
Uh-huh.
They closed the other several dozen they had.
Well, you know, David, who would have thought, you know, 40 years ago we would be passionate about the right to vote? You know, it's a lot
back
of
to this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Forward motion.
You know, if politics are local, then I'm becoming more apolitical because I live in this lovely little, I don't live in Portland. I don't live in Louisville. I live in Detroit. You know,
no riot cops in Shelburne Falls.
There are none. No, no. You know, and what we did, you know, we did have a demonstration.
Is there even a police department?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, last time I checked. Actually, Shelburne Falls is two towns that meet at a river. So we have a Shelburne Police Department and we have a Buckland Police Department. We had a big demonstration here, which was like 200 people. But, you know, there's only 2,400 people in the town. So that's a pretty good turnout.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah. And, you know, and we all knelt down on one knee for 8 minutes and 46 seconds or whatever it was, which is a pretty amazing experience to do. But it really is, huh?
Just kneeling on one knee. I mean, even just kneeling on one knee for that long. Yeah. I mean, when you do that, you realize like, wow, this is what a way to kill somebody.
Gives you a lot of time to think about what.
That's a lot of, yeah. Yeah. Charlie, it's been such a pleasure.
We should go and, you know, put a post-it note on the police car or the police station saying, you know, we could have really done some terrible things here if you were worse or something like that. Right.
That's about the Shelburne Falls level of militancy.
Yeah.
It's a happy little town. Yeah.
So, beyond that,
any particular closing words to our sprawling audience of militant teenagers?
I would say that I would say we need to open our hearts. I think the thing, political thing, I'm most afraid of at this point in my life, and I'm 73, is that we are going to close our hearts and our minds and our borders at a time when our actions are driving people away from their homes. And that's a politically energized message now in Europe. I don't know if you've been back to Europe since a lot of these right-wing parties have gained ground, but certainly you don't have to go to Europe for that. We can get that at home. So I guess that would be it. Realize that we've done a lot of damage and now we have to open our hearts to the consequences of that.
Excellent advice. Yeah. Thanks, Charlie. Hope to talk to you soon.
I'd like that, David. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that was a discussion with Charlie King in Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, a singer-songwriter extraordinaire who you can find if you look up online, charlieking.org, or just search for his name on various other platforms. You'll come up with lots of music and videos and such. And that's all for me for now. You can find this broadcast archived on the Facebook pages of KBOO Community Radio and the Facebook page of Popular Resistance, as well as my own Facebook pages and YouTube and Twitter, VK, Twitch, LinkedIn, and then also it goes out as a podcast shortly if you look for This Week with David Rovix wherever you get your podcasts. Have a good weekend, everybody out there, and I will be back to host Fifth Estate Live on Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. And remember, don't pay the rent. Mutual aid will get us through. Trust your neighbors.